This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
On Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, that was a community choir called Shaking the Tree with their little ditty called Strangers and Foreigners.
That was very cute, wasn't it? I think there is an inner dickhead in all of this. Don't be too cocky.
That's
so
right.
To speak.
Exactly. Thank you, Shaking the Tree, for that little contribution. That would hark back to the old days of Saturday Magazine when Jeff Hood used to play some very quirky little numbers.
He did indeed. Just after 11, you used to tune in and go, "What the hell is that? Who are those two guys that sing, those American guys?
Romanofsky and Phillips.
They're the ones.
Yeah, Jeff, next time you're on, bit of Romanofsky and Phillips. It's been a little while. You are on Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, and we'll be speaking very shortly to Marilyn Beaumont, who is a woman of immense talent, experience and life.
Particularly in the health sector, women's health.
And she'll be sharing her journey with us. And one of the things she did for quite some time was be a member of the Ministerial Advisory Committee on Gay and Lesbian Health in Victoria, which has done some significant work over the years.
That's right. But in the meantime, Marg.
Leanne. 94.9, and good morning to Sue. Thanks for your text, which you sent us ages ago. We got distracted, so I hope you're still listening, Sue. Thanks for the lovely message.
That's right. And before that, I think we had Sophie B.
We did. Damn. Oh, damn. Leanne, I wish I was your lover. Oh, no,
well,
sorry.
Take a ticket. It's like the deli. Take a ticket, honey.
Oh, yours is back in town tomorrow, so hands off.
9:40, flight arrives. Hands off.
Mind on the job.
That's the one indeed.
And the job at hand is, Leanne.
Our journey segment, one of our regular segments here on Saturday Magazine, and we're very pleased to welcome Marilyn Beaumont into the Joy Studios. Good morning.
Good morning, Leanne, Marg.
Thanks for coming.
It's a pleasure.
Giving up your Saturday morning in between renovations.
Not completely given up.
Did you have to go out for breakfast because you haven't got a kitchen?
No. I rose and I did that.
Good on you. Now, you're the Executive Director of Women's Health Victoria, but I'm thinking there's a lot that happened in your life before you got into this role. I know that you were born and bred in Canberra. Now, I think of Canberra as being a place that people go to, are transferred to or go to for political or work aspirations. I don't know that many sort of people that were born there. Can you tell us a bit about growing up in Canberra?
I think you started by saying I was born and bred there. I think I was born there. I think I was bred elsewhere.
Ah, okay. But, I stand corrected.
I think it's a very strange. It was a very strange place before the lake. So I grew up in Yarralumla, which was a housing commission suburb. My father is a builder and came from England after the war as part of the building of Canberra. We had my mother left at age 3, and so he was left with myself and two older sisters, and Matt remarried into another big family with two more girls, and they subsequently had a boy. So we had a very sort of mixed family,
and quite
difficult in terms of income. Mm. I spent a lot of time by the river. Not in class. a lot of time yabbying.
Well, I guess it was pretty rural.
Yeah, we would walk all day in the paddocks at the back of Yarralumla with a shilling's worth of broken biscuits for our lunch.
Mm. And, she is 167.
No, I remember that too, because you get the tin of bickies down at the grocer's.
Absolutely.
And you could get the broken ones in a brown paper bag.
That's right, absolutely.
I remember that too. Oh, during the war.
Yeah, but even, you know, getting them out of wholesale sort of tins in brown paper bags is... you wouldn't find that anywhere now.
No. And you don't think of Canberra, I certainly don't think of Canberra's housing commission areas and things like that. You just kind of have this image of this pristine, beautifully designed, perfect city almost. Yeah, someone had to build it.
There's a bit of an underbelly to Canberra. There's a very significant class divide, I think.
Yep.
A lot of the... there are a lot of people who live in Canberra who are not well off. There's quite a bit of homelessness, significant drug addiction and so on. So I think that I know all of that. I also know the other side of it, which is the bureaucracy and political side of it. I've been to Canberra for work It's quite odd to go into Parliament House at one stage and be there in the members' dining room with the politicians I was meeting with, and having my sister wait on the table, having a really? Brother-in-law drive a government car. So it's quite an odd mixture.
Mm. Yeah.
But I love it. I mean, I would never live there, but I do. I think it was good for my education. We spent a lot of time watching Parliament during the course of learning about democracy. I think it's just stood me in good stead, even though I left at 15, worked in a shop as my first job. But it's been, I think, a good background.
So was it hard on your dad, having your mum leave with a small family? I mean, he obviously had to work and earn the money. How do you think he dealt with all that?
I think it's amazing that he kept us together. I mean, if you think about, I wasn't, you know, I'm not 100 and what did you say, 36 at some 67. Stage. So I was only born in 1951. And so thinking about the 50s, that was a period of time where men being single with three small children would be very, very unusual.
Yeah, it would be often more common that you'd be sent off to some other relative to care for you, wouldn't it?
But he didn't have a family here, from what you're saying.
No, he didn't have a family. He did have a distant relative who I have since made contact with, who lives in Victoria, and she came sort of on a world trip from Yorkshire in England, and was in Melbourne and came to stay with us for a period of time, I understand. I don't remember that, but I know photographs, and she's since shown me a lot of photographs of us at that time.
Okay, so she was around and there. So you said school wasn't your favourite thing. You preferred to be yabbying and out pottering around by the river. So you got out for school as soon as you could?
There wasn't a focus on education in our family, so there was never any discussion of continuing on once you were at a legal age to leave.
Mm. That's what you did. Well, you guess you needed the money from working, or just that wasn't the culture?
I think that as a girl, you either thought about doing teaching or nursing, or as my dad would say, well, you're going to get married, why do you need an education? Well, I think even that is a really good lesson.
So you said you left at 15. Where did you go?
I worked in a department store called JB Young's in what was called the fancy department.
Oh, what do you sell in the fancy department?
Fancy things, I'd say.
Very fancy. Buttons, lace, the first pantyhose. I had to teach women how to put them on.
Oh, here we go. Here's
the
story.
That was the beginning of everything, really, wasn't it, Marilyn?
Very interesting. And those funny stockings that sort of had elastic tops that stuck to your legs.
So you didn't have to wear suspenders.
That's right.
That sort of pantyhose.
It took all the fun out of stockings, didn't it? Not having to wear suspenders.
Quite an interesting evolution.
Yeah, there at the beginning, so to speak, weren't you?
Yeah, and wool and a whole mixture of stuff.
So
very strange. Yeah. Waiting for the selection of the buttons drove me crazy at times.
I imagine it would take a long, long time to do that. That'd be a bit, I mean, no offence, but a bit dull, wouldn't it?
I was waiting to go nursing. I was waiting.
Oh, so you had to be
17. So I left Canberra when I was 16 and a half, went to Sydney and started nursing.
So a bit of a change hitting Sydney? Had you travelled to Sydney much in your teen years?
We spent quite a bit of time in Sydney on holiday in Manly and places like that. Sydney's pretty close to Canberra. Most people in Canberra are familiar with Sydney. I think getting there had just been this long wait. I spent a lot of time as a young person waiting.
Yeah. And as a teenager in Sydney, what was that like for you?
When I first started nursing, we had to live in the nurse's home. If you married, you had to leave nursing. If you're pregnant, you had to leave nursing. It was a very controlled environment. And yet there was this other odd side of it where, because the hospital was at Prince Henry, which is out at La Perouse in Sydney, out past Malabar, they had a hospital bus which would take a load of nurses into the city, and the last bus would leave Taylor Square at the top of Oxford Street at midnight to come back to the hospital. But that was in the period of time of the Americans having R&R in Sydney during the Vietnam War. And so a load of nurses would be taken into town and go on a yacht with the Americans.
God, I bet you lost a lot of the pregnant nurses over the years.
It was amazing. So we had this sort of weird juxtaposition.
Yeah. Of moral standards.
Amazing.
Double standards.
Amazing. Mm.
So who organised that? Was the matron a bit of a madam or something?
Sounds like it.
She was, was on the payroll of the US Navy.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm not sure. But we always knew about those events. We always knew when, you know, there was something on. There was a lot of time spent in, you know, the hotels around Bondi and King's Cross and down
amazing,
near the...
Isn't it? Like young, impressionable, vulnerable girls, a lot of them presumably...
From the country.
Mm. And the days where, you know, drug, sex and rock and roll was really just probably hitting its strides.
Mm. And young, vulnerable sailors a long way from home and, you know, like everybody was young and
it's
stupid.
It's a recipe for disaster, really.
Yeah, it is a recipe, but it's also a recipe for, you know, learning resilience.
Yeah, survival, I guess, and what
absolutely.
You want to do and don't want to do.
So what did you learn from those years?
Swim.
It's probably an early lesson in assertiveness.
Yeah.
I was not going to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
I was not going to have to deal with that so early in my life. I'd seen so much of that around me. I had a life to live, which I'd only just begun. I'd been waiting to get on with it for so long.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that my work was important. As early as 16, 17, to me, work was important. It was my way out of, you know, lives that I really didn't want to.
A path you didn't want to take.
No, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So that's sort of pretty, I don't know, in-depth thinking for someone of that age. I mean, it must take a strength of character or a motivation to feel so strongly about what you knew you wanted to achieve. So you didn't feel any sort of peer pressure to be involved, or did you find outlets for other activities?
Certainly I joined. Certainly I spent a lot of time drinking too much.
Yeah.
There was a lot of a whole mixture of drugs around at that time. A lot of my friends got into heroin. Some have died. Some have been through prison. I just knew where to draw the line.
Very
mature young woman.
Well, I spent a lot of time in my own head as a young person, a very young person, waiting to get on with my life. So I was very introspective, very silent as a child. And I think that I just had this sense of nobody else is going to bail me out. I have to look after myself. Nobody's around to do it for me.
So clear.
Yeah.
When you lose your mum at three, you kind of grow up quickly, don't you?
I think so.
Marilyn, you've chosen Heaven, the Ice House song, as one to bring into us this morning. Any reason?
Well, I've always loved music, and I do love the irreverence of the vocals in this. And I love Peter Gabriel's music and Talking Heads and all. But this one just seemed to hit a chord, and it's as if people think that at the end of their life they'll go to heaven, and the words in this song are stunning.
All right, well, let's have a listen. You're listening to Saturday Magazine with Margaret Leanne on Joy 94.9. Our special guest this morning is Marilyn Beaumont.
You're on Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, and our special guest this morning is Marilyn Beaumont, who's the Executive Director for Women's Health Victoria, and she's held that position since 1995. And Marilyn has been honoured with life membership of the South Australian branch of the Australian Nurses Federation and the Tasmanian branch. She was awarded the Australian Centenary of Federation Medal for Significant Services to Women's Health in 2003 and was inducted to the Victorian Honour Roll of Women for her leadership and advocacy in improving women's health in 2007. A career that started off as a little old nurse in Sydney, which has just blossomed into some incredible stuff, Marilyn.
Yeah, wow. Little old nurse, little young nurse. It was, I think nursing is an amazing career, and I think the diversity of ways in which you can take that anywhere in the world is enormous. So that's been really wonderful for me. But I've had some extraordinary mentors. I think that the support of others is something which always underpins wherever you go in life, and But, you know, I think that I've never had a plan. Things have happened, and people have supported me to make different things happen.
So we talked about you had a plan to get out, and once you got out into the world, then as things happened, you just took the opportunities and people influenced you in doing that.
And I've worked in a lot of different places in Australia, so I was a bit of a wanderer for a while, but eventually found that my place was back in Sydney working with homeless people, and the beginnings of the HIV AIDS incidents began to emerge in Sydney at the time.
Yep.
I was working in a clinic in East Sydney, very significant point. That working with homeless people led me to working with young street kids. That led me to much more of understanding how some people sort of fall off the edge.
Yeah, so more marginalised groups.
Yeah,
and just,
yeah. That, and I became much more involved in that. Led me much more to be saying that isn't right. There's something must happen. We must do something much more about that than what I call putting a Band-Aid on for a person.
Yeah,
there are things which lead to the complexity of the crisis that they're in that putting a Band-Aid on won't fix. So I became much more involved politically at the policy level.
So to make to affect those changes rather than just deal with the outcome of lack of change.
Yeah,
so.
I found it impossible to turn my mind off what I was doing as not being enough, that there was always another layer, and it took me from working at the local level to working at the state level to working at the national level, and now I sort of combine them all.
So I understand there was a pretty significant event which got you into really got you into activism.
Well, couple of points, but as a student nurse, we all sat exams together in this huge hall. There were hundreds of us, and the head nurse educator at the time told us that three of our colleagues wouldn't be sitting the exam because they'd come into the nurse's home or hadn't come back to the nurse's home that night, so had been out all night. And we sat there thinking about that for a while, and I stood up and I said, I don't think that's right. Because they were out all night doesn't mean that they're incapable of sitting their exam.
And this was in the exam room?
Yeah.
Was the exam about to start?
And I just said, I'm not going to sit it either. And I remained standing.
Ooh.
How many people joined you?
Well, slowly the whole, you know, room started to stand. And that was
shivers up my spine now. It's sort of like one of those movies you see where people just,
Amazing experience. And so I didn't think about the consequences when I stood. And I think that's the thing. You have to stand up. You have to take a risk.
Yeah, literally. But the passion, your passion and your sense, I guess, of fairness or rightness overrode any personal detriment for you.
There weren't any consequences for me at that time. I didn't think what happens if they say, okay, don't leave the room.
You're on your feet before you knew what you were doing. Damn. So what did happen?
We just waited until they came into the room, then we all sat down and got on with it.
Yeah. Great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, you know, and then I think one of the other major incident for me was around working with street kids, and the place where I was working and also living, it was a new idea around a therapeutic community. And the the philosophy of the place was it's all right to be involved in heavy drinking as long as you don't take the illegal drugs. And some of the street politics were being played out in the house in terms of some individuals favoured over others. I think even to the point of sexual exploitation of some of the women. And I found that it confronted me as a nurse, because I was not employed as a nurse. I was not employed in a permanent position. I was employed on a short-term contract. I found that weird. So I was already a unionist at the time. It confronted me in terms of the ethics the place where I was working, and then as a sort of the early days of feminism for me, and the way in which women were being exploited, even in a therapeutic community, and I started to raise questions about that. Now, it took a long time to resolve it. I ended up with no job, but I learned some extraordinary lessons, and that led me into working for the... I was eventually employed as an organiser in the union.
So you were Federal Secretary of the Australian Nursing Federation from 1987 to 1995.
Mm. That's a long time. 8 years.
And a very challenging period in nursing, speaking of unionism.
Yeah, that's right. Well, during that time we moved from an apprenticeship style education to university based education. We moved from no career structure in a clinical setting, only in terms of administration or education, into a clinically based career structure. Mm-hmm. The issue of equal pay was resolved at that time. We achieved industry-based superannuation and have a really good superannuation fund.
Significant leaps,
and in the face of massive public, opposition to the
the strike years,
to what the nurses were doing to stand up for
That's
their rights.
Right. Yeah, the first strikes for nurses, the removal of the Royal from the Royal Australian Nursing Federation name. That was interesting. I had to write to the Governor General and so on that we didn't want to use the term anymore. Even learning what the process was pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. So all of the national plebiscites of the membership.
Yep.
The membership growth was extraordinary over those years. The bringing of the New South Wales Nurses Association, the Queensland Nurses Union, into the National Federation was achieved in those years. National recognition of nurses' qualifications. I could never understand why we had to have different arrangements in each of the states and territories.
Apart from bureaucracy and
I knew what barriers empires. They were because I'd worked in a number of them.
Yep. So you'd already gone through that at a practical level. Mm. I mean, you're rattling all these things off, but I mean, they're significant.
It was phenomenal
in terms
times.
Of, occupational history in Australia. Mm. That's significant stuff that a lot of other workforce groups haven't achieved now.
Yeah.
What was it? Because I know that you are a wonderful woman achieving that, but there must have been a team as well. What was it about that group and team and the executive of the union at the time that made these huge advances?
I think that we had such a long way to come from.
Yeah.
I think for me, my understanding of myself as a feminist and understanding equality and the right to achieve these things. So I was not a nurse that thought of dedication was enough. And being really clear about those things and being able to speak about them with authority and knowledge, both personal experience and also speaking about it on behalf of thousands and thousands.
Yeah.
The states and territories were also fundamental to it. I mean, the action here in Victoria at the time assisted the environment to change. Of course it did. All of those nurses on the picket lines and the public support for nurses at that time was extraordinary and remains really high.
Oh, I remember honking every time we went past honk the crowd.
Yeah. So I think that there was just this fundamental shift in understanding about what nursing is and who nurses are. And that it's more than a white goods job now.
Mm.
That was a little bit of pocket money to buy the white goods and then...
Before you married a doctor and settled down.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But, you know, there is an extraordinary power in nursing when you harness it.
Mm.
And I think that we've been through and are going through a period of extraordinary workforce shortages where it's sometimes easier for a nurse to work for an agency and then you don't get that connection to the profession of nursing in the same way at all.
Yeah, just an individual that sort of goes in and does the job.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, yeah, the, I guess the sort of demographic of nurses have changed too, just where they've come from and their backgrounds and things like that. So it's very different. So you got, after 8 years, left the ANF, had a big holiday, I hope.
Well, I lost the election.
Good heavens!
Amazing, I know. But you know, the politics of managing a national federation of state branches is an extraordinary thing.
I guess you had to make some enemies along the way, didn't you?
Of course.
Mm.
And I was also, you know, the first rank and file nurse to be elected to the position. I was not at the level of director of nursing. So, you know, there was a bit of a campaign against me as a lesbian. Mm. There were things at play. 8 years is a long time. I was very tired. I'd been in an elected position for 13 years with the South Australian work as well.
Yep.
So I basically took on gardening.
Still working with your hands, though.
Yeah. So solitude.
Yeah.
Doing gardening.
No people.
That's right.
Yeah.
Fairly instant rewards.
Absolutely.
Nobody dies on you. Well, plants, but you can, you know. I want to pick up on that, you know, opposition to you as a lesbian. In I'm fascinated by
a women's organisation. Predominantly women's.
Yeah. Where did that come from? What was that?
Maybe opposition to me as a lesbian is too strong a term. It's the process when you're a public figure or you're in an elected position. Mm. Where the opposition look for something which they can use against you.
A perceived weakness or a, whatever.
Yeah. Or what the mainstream might see is, oh no, well, we don't support it. Yeah. No,
she's a lesbian, what do you expect?
Yeah, but I didn't.
They're implying a whole lot of other agendas which aren't there.
Yes.
But then, you know, the other side of it is that the openness and honesty of being out also has its rewards, and they were often expressed. You know, there were many nurses, many women who were clearly knew and understood and expressed that to me.
Yeah. So
it was quite difficult to be out during a lot of those years anyway.
Yeah, generally speaking, I know. Yeah. I know. It's, you know, it's sort of interesting with what's going on in Fed Square today that, you know, we're not talking that long ago.
No.
That people weren't out in the workplace very, very rarely. So
that's right.
So after your gardening, that's when you got into women's health in a sort of broader
level? Well, I didn't really have a sense of what my capacities were because you're sort of constantly
too busy doing it.
So and a friend at the time, Anne Mitchell, in fact.
All right,
good. We know Anne's been in this very chair
a number of times
in the hot seat.
Who was on the board of the organisation, the predecessor organisation to Women's Health Victoria, and she spoke to me about coming and talking to them about the chief executive officer position and what the organisation needed. And I did, and I'm still there.
Wow. What's the next stage? Because sadly, I wish we had another hour and a half, Marilyn. I'm having a great time. I think we need to go out for lunch. What's the next stage of the journey? Because it's been an incredible ride.
I think the things that I do just keep building on one another. Mm. I think that I'm very tuned into what's going on in the world and in Australia and, you know, the opportunity to where women are being vilified or attacked or, I mean, what was happening that led up to the removal of abortion from the Crimes Act in Victoria. I mean, that was a 4 or 5 year campaign.
Yep.
I love those things. Mm-hmm. They're hard work, but the rewards are enormous. Yeah, and I think I've got a few more of those in me
yet. Well, I was going to say, you know, unfortunately, we're not over our campaigns and issues. There is still a lot of fighting to do. One question for you. A lot of people from the union movement have gone into politics with big names.
Mm.
Anything that you've thought about?
I was approached at one stage to stand in the seat of Canberra, in fact.
Well, yes, you know politics, let's face it, coming from there.
I was not prepared to. I don't think that I was not. I've never been a member of a political party.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want my life scrutinised to that degree. I didn't want to travel to that degree? And I've said no.
Yeah, it's a lot of life. And, yeah, you have to be, I guess, clear about what you're prepared to give and whatever. So we've only got a minute or so left. We haven't really touched on women's health, but can you maybe say in 25 words or less what the state of women's health in Victoria is at the moment, where we sort of stand and what needs to be done?
Yeah, I think we're doing quite well. I think we're pretty well organised and have a significant number of strengths in terms of women in positions within academia, research, practice settings, service delivery. I think we've gone a long way to understanding the health impact of intimate partner violence on mm-hmm. women's health and wellbeing. There's
I know it's a project close to your heart.
A great move in this state to use a range of different settings, including workplaces, to raise awareness as to how we could do better as a community to prevent violence and the impact that it has, particularly on women and children.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.